I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Vice Gaming Podcast. Thanks for choosing to listen to this episode, in which I'm joined by two indie games makers extraordinaire. I should say that. They can retract that if they want to later on. I'm joined by Mike Bithell.
Hello.
And by Dan Fountain.
Hello.
Hello, guys. Do you want to quickly tell the listener at home or on the move, wherever they might be, exactly what it is you do? Dan, why don't you fire away?
Sure. I work for a company called State of Play. We're a team of 4 or 5 recently, and we made a game called Lumino City. We've got another game coming out called Inks, and yeah, we like to make indie games.
Indie games. And Lumino City did very well, didn't it? I believe it won a prestigious award roughly this time last year.
Yeah, this time last year we won a BAFTA for visual achievement.
That's no small thing, is it? That's
Epic, yeah, sitting there
did
on our shelf.
Did you poop yourself?
Yeah, it was an out-of-body experience, honestly. Like, I didn't know what was happening, but... There we go.
But the award just showed up the next day, and you're like, "Well, that was really real."
Yeah, it's making sure that we are very worried that the next game's ever going to top that. It's staring at us
we
in the office.
We will get on to such pressures, I'm sure. But Mike as well. Mike,
speaking of which pressures, hello,
hello. Yes, I mean, people might know you from Thomas Was Alone and Volume.
Yes.
Which both did okay, and you've both done very well. One of those little BAFTA awards before as well. Well,
I've briefly held Danny's. Danny Wallace, the voice actor on Thomas Was Alone, was rightly won the BAFTA. He did a really great job. It's been a really cool ride. I'm sure we're going to talk about all of it in great
depth.
Let's talk about that ride. Yes.
As Dan said, you know, this is indie games. Indie games. What does indie games even mean in 2016? Let's throw that open to the panel of two.
We're going to sort this out.
But no, I mean, you know, for people listening, I'm sure you're very aware of what video games are and understand maybe what independent film is, what independent music is. But maybe in video games, you're thinking, well, what's the difference between something like Volume, for instance, and Metal Gear Solid 5?
$50 million.
There you go. That's a good start.
It's ultimately, in the words of my mother, you're not indie. Indies are cool. And I think it is that we're in this weird point. It's happened with independent film. It's happened with independent music, where indie started off as a useful description of like the means of production. You know, indie came from independent, meaning not made with a publisher or a big corporation behind it. But as time's gone on, you know, I think indie now is more of it's a genre, it's an approach, it's a state of mind. And it kind of can mean absolutely everything and absolutely nothing, depending on who you're talking to, in exactly the same way as saying, oh, that's a cool indie film. It might be an indie film that's been funded by a mega corporation, or it might be an indie film that's made as a passion project of someone for $10,000. They both, you know, deserve the mantle, I think. And I think the same is becoming true of games.
Yeah. So for Dan, for you, I mean, you say you work in a team of 5 at the moment. I mean, when I look at a company like Frontier, for example, which is technically an independent, they're not owned by anyone and they're making Elite and they're doing a Planet Coaster now, of course. And they must have, I think they've got like 200 people. So in your head, like, is that just as much an indie company as State of Play?
So in my head, the fact that a company would be independent would mean that they are kind of more free to make their own decisions. And one issue for me, if our company was to grow that big, is then we'd have to start taking on projects or making compromises to just pay people, not have anyone like go redundant. So for me, at a level where we are, we're very versatile and able to make decisions that we feel artistically best. and hopefully that pays off without having to feel like we're not independent to our own to sustaining ourselves. I find that more of a helpful definition of indie.
Yeah. I mean, so does it come down to, I mean, you kind of said almost like a state of mind as a joke, but at the same time, bigger game studios will go through meetings with several people to decide whether or not something is appropriate to their target demographic, maybe, or to the console of choice, whatever. And maybe an independent developer or a small team just thinks, we just want to make this because it's going to be cool.
I think you might be underestimating indies. I think a lot of indies totally have those. I know we do, and I think lots of indies, I think we're all making stuff for audiences, and you know, we're you know, charging money for those games. So I think there is always those conversation around kind of, you know, is this something people want? Is this something that we think makes sense at this budget? Or I honestly feel like, and you also have, I mean, you have the big studios, your Ubisofts, for example, releasing games that are, you know, arguably indie games. They're smaller projects. They're these cool little things. I don't think that what I make is more worthy than those projects, and vice versa. I think it's all it's becoming very, very murky, and I think that's actually fine. I think that's good. I think effectively the definition of what a video game is has just broadened in a really cool way, and I think we should celebrate that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say about Ubisoft and sort of putting out. I mean, there was Grow Home, wasn't there? And prior to that, Child of Light, and
the one with the dog,
the World War One game.
World War One. I actually handed them their story BAFTA last year, and I can't think. What's this? Valiant Hearts,
indeed. You know, which we might say are. It's not that they're taking cues from the indie sector as such, but maybe they're thinking, you know, we can make these smaller games, and because we know there's now an audience for it. I mean, do you think that you know, companies like yours have helped bigger studios realize this, that people do want, it's not like it's a more intimate personal experience all the time, but you know, not everything has to be super glossy and sound like a Hollywood blockbuster.
I think there's a lot of cross-pollination in both directions. I think you can look at something like, say, Gone Home, which was made by a lot of kind of first-person shooter developers.
It's the old Bioshock people.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, a few of the team. And you look at Gone Home, and Gone Home is basically the first 45 minutes of any first-person shooter, like the story-establishing stuff, the stuff that I love, actually.
Before all the murdering begins.
So it's gone in that direction. Of course, like Thomas Was Alone's platformer, massively inspired by every platformer I ever played from every major company, and Volume very much owes a debt to Konami with Metal Gear Solid. So there's that way. And yeah, I think there's definitely things you can point to in modern games. I think a lot of mobile game mechanics have found their way into all kinds of games, and most of those are from games that were developed by independent studios. So that's a very obvious and straightforward one. But there's, yeah, I think all over the place there are these influences creeping in. And yes, the smaller game, demonstrating that there's a market for a smaller game has been central to that.
I think one thing that's healthy for the games industry, which a lot of other industries like film would have had, is just that time to experiment. And once you start upping your budgets to 50 million or whatever, you start, the risks go way up. And yeah, like Ubisoft and that kind of company that have started to allow Gone Home to be published by them is obviously realizing that they're allowing their developers to do their own passion projects, which was Gone Home, I hear, was designed from one of the animators doing this, the procedural.
Grow Home.
One of the animators was playing with procedural animation, right, and that just turned into a passion project. That space to invent, I think, comes a lot easier when there's less risk.
Because that was kind of made, like you say, internally. It's just like, oh my God, this is great, guys. Let's see what people make of it.
Yeah, and then the fact that indie, quote-unquote indie games are being seen as more viable and popular, that allows someone like Ubisoft to realize it is worth taking a shot at.
So. Yeah. And it being on a PS Plus thing didn't hurt, I'm sure, after a while. Well, let's talk about, we mentioned you know, wonderful successes of awards and great reviews as well for all games as well. Dan, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, you mentioned it, talking about like what we do next.
Right.
So when you are that small team and it's just you and you're, it's not like the team shifts that much. Like, how do you approach the next project? I mean, of course you had it after Thomas Was Alone as well, Mike, you know, when you're thinking, you know, they loved that, but we can't just do that again, can we? You know, you can't do, well, I know Loom went into Lumino City, but you know,
yeah,
maybe you can get away with a third, I don't know.
Yeah.
Lumino City Infinite.
I mean, maybe that's one of the freedoms of being able to do what we want, is if we feel putting in a certain direction, we can do that, rather than our publisher saying we want a sequel. at the same time, we're doing these projects because we love them. So we'd love to make something. We from Lumino City, we want to take some of the aesthetic. We also want to take the narrative. We learn a lot about all these things and how to make them. So, yeah, for us, we kind of had a bit of downtime after Lumino City was finished. But we're working on a game right now, which is going to be released in a couple of weeks. And the way we came up with that was...
Is that Inks?
That's Inks. It's a pinball game. It's pinball, but a puzzle version of pinball. So it came for, like, this is how we kind of come up with ideas. On a Friday, we'd just come up with anything and we just make whatever we wanted without any pressure. Mm. So that's one
are
of the ways.
Are there donuts involved?
They're not donuts. That's a good, it's a good show.
I mean, that would make people sluggish, yeah. Wouldn't it? That would slow the process.
Yeah.
Sugar, but without the sluggishness.
Well, there's a lot of coffee.
That'll do it.
So that came out of a passion of what if we take this idea and mash it with this idea and merge it together. So what we ended up with is somewhat of a puzzle pinball game. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of...
That's how we keep ourselves free. That's done and it's just not out yet.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure when this podcast is going out. April.
It'll be out. Within April.
Within April. So maybe you've already played it. You could leave a comment below or wherever you're listening to. Don't if you're driving a car, don't stop and leave a comment. Stop and leave a comment.
Yeah, please stop and leave a comment.
Don't comment while on the move.
Don't move. Yes.
So Mike, for you to go, because you know, obviously a pinball puzzle game is very different from what Lumino City was, which is a more kind of environmental based, you know, wonderfully hand built. Yeah. I mean, it looks absolutely bloody delicious for want of a better expression. It's just an incredible looking game. Thomas Was Alone was very basic looking, deliberately mm-hmm. so, and it looks wonderful in its own terms as well. I mean, I love the way it looks. I love the movement as well. I mean,
thank you.
There's so much fun to be had just bouncing these blocks off each other. But Volume, like you already said, is like, you know, the semi-Metal Gear inspired mm-hmm. stealth game, and I've played a lot of that as well. And that's quite a switch, isn't it? Both in terms of aesthetics, game style.
Yeah.
It's not like you've just gone, hey, I'm really good at making this type of game, I'm going to make that again. It's like, hey, forget what you know about Mike Biffle right now, guys.
Yeah, and I think that's going to continue, to be honest, from the things we're doing right now. I think, it's not... For me, it's about constantly wanting to do different things. I don't think that's to do with my background. You know, I was working in bigger studios, and, you know, we would build the same kind of thing a few times. And that's cool. And, you know, companies that have spent, you know, 20 years making first-person shooters make really awesome first-person shooters. Mm. So I'd never knock anyone for taking that approach, but I like to mix things up. But then at the same time, I'd say that actually a lot of these games... especially my games have a lot of similarities between them in terms of the underlying kind of design. So yes, Thomas Was Alone and Volume are very different, but they're both puzzle games. They're mm-hmm. both kind of scratching certain itches from a design point of view. So yeah, I think I'll continue to do that. The next thing we have coming up, which I've never not said anything about yet, that is a completely different genre again to those two. And the thing after that will probably be very different mm-hmm. again. I want to keep making those various things. But then also every now and again, I you know, get that hankering to do a sequel at some point. So I might go back to one of these and expand it at some point.
Thomas wasn't quite so alone.
Yeah, but... sequel names are hard. Yeah.
Thomas found some pals. Well, he does find some pals, of course he does.
Yes.
But I mean, it's on the sort of tech side, I'm wondering about kind of accessibility to tools. You know, we know that big devs, like I walk into a big studio and they're just, you know, stuff everywhere. I think you're quite interested in VR, aren't you, Mike? Is that something
I play with VR.
VR. I mean, is that something that you can see the indie sector really grabbing hold of? I mean, I've had a lot of fun with
it. Yeah, very much so at the moment. At the moment, it's a running joke now, I think, amongst a lot of indies that, like, everyone's very excited about VR. And I am. We're making an expansion for Volume, mm-hmm. which focuses on the VR, which is coming along really well. That's for PlayStation VR. But... yeah, it's actually getting to a point where, because everyone's jumping onto it, I'm often talking to kind of younger indies and going, maybe make something else, maybe go somewhere. Like, because when indie devs have done very well, because obviously we don't have access to massive marketing budgets, we don't have access to a lot of the structures where you can kind of purchase success. We usually do very well when we're doing the thing that isn't the consensus opinion. So when, you know... back when you could not make a non-free-to-play mobile game, these guys made a really great premium mobile game. Mm. And when PC was dead, you know, Thomas Was Alone did very well on PC. And then when console was dead, it did very well on console. Like, it's being a step away from the crowd often works. But VR is very interesting. And there's a lot of opportunity there. There's a lot of support from the platform holders. There's a lot of ways of getting games made on those platforms. But right now, it's just everyone's just waiting with bated breath to see if gamers actually like that kit. We all like it because we're nerds.
Mm.
But will the audience...
Do you think VR is quite a hard sell for the household?
I think it's a hard thing. I think it's a hard sell in general, simply because the experience of playing VR is very hard to convey. That's the big challenge. Mm. You show a video or a trailer, people go, oh yeah, I get it. It's a first-person video game. But it's not that. And conveying that's very tricky.
I think conveying a sense of what it feels like to be in a place is the hardest bit. Like, you can't possibly show a trailer for that.
So getting these things into shopping malls, I think it's very similar. It reminds me a lot of the Nintendo Wii. In that, like, Nintendo Wii you got when you held that controller in your hand. But the great thing about the Nintendo Wii, which VR doesn't have, is you could show a video of someone having fun with it and waving it around, and you get it. VR's tricky, I think.
It reminds me of when people try and show HDTV adverts on TV. How do you
those
show...
Those old DVD trailers on video VHS where it showed, like, this is what VHS looks like and this is what DVD looks like. I'm watching a VHS. Why don't you make the
round? How do you do that, but in the round?
It's very tricky, and we're all struggling to work out how... I think there's a few approaches that we're going to experiment with to kind of try and advertise a game for VR without showing it to you in VR.
Yeah. Is that something that State of Play is interested in? In my head, like, State of Play is a little bit more about... slightly smaller. Not the VR can't be small, but like, I mean, could you do Lumino from VR? Could you be up that close to the cardboard?
Well, that's a good question. We're going to have to get some 360 degree cameras and videos.
There's some very interesting stuff being done in film in VR,
Yeah, there are. We've seen some interesting stories being told all around you, and there's some really interesting, like, telling a story in VR. You have to make sure people, you know, where people are looking. So we're interested in that. We're interested in telling story. Also, it throws up a lot of interesting questions for me. We aren't used to making things that deliberately look exactly like the real world. So for State of Play, coming from that point of view, where we're definitely not thinking this needs to look like the real world, what would it be like if we were inside a model? What would it be like if we were inside a screen print or a drawing? Mm. So I'm very interested in experimenting in the future with much more different questions like that. Making a whole new world, a whole new aesthetic. Why should something have a physical shader on it, you know?
It's something we've certainly experienced with our VR tests, where, because we're prototyping lots of things and playing with lots of ideas, and there's a there's going to be a pretentious term for it. It's going to be the ludonarrative dissonance of 2016. Someone's going to come up with a term for it, but basically there's this weird effect with VR that even if you make something that is completely, as you say, kind of completely unrealistic, completely not necessarily abstract, but just like just nothing, like just in literally you put a sphere with just flat color on it, no rendering at all, there's still a sense of reality to it in VR. There's still a sense of presence and physicality. All of those tricks that we've learned over the years of applying bump maps, you know, crazy levels of real actual physical shader, the technology, the second you put something in VR, it just feels real. And you don't need to lean on that stuff, which in theory opens up amazing new kind of aesthetic approaches. Like I say, someone's going to come up with that, a pretentious term for that idea of, I guess it's linked to presence, but this idea of the reality of a VR space, and that's a fun thing to play with, and in theory opens the doors wide open to loads of really creative projects.
And you say you're doing the Volume 1 with Sony VR. I mean, they're obviously, you know, they're very optimistic about their hardware, but that kind of brings me on to kind of the platform gatekeepers, for want of a better expression, which is an expression I keep repeating. The old way of thinking about indie games is very much like, here's a game you play on your computer or whatever. It's not necessarily on the consoles. We did see Sony really switch it up, and Microsoft kind of slowly followed them. I know Thomas is on Nintendo.
It's boring now.
It's looking a bit lonely over there, isn't it? There's not a lot on the Wii U or whatever, I mean, and the 3DS. But how have you both found those experiences? Because you're on iOS as well, aren't you?
Yeah.
Lumino's not on console.
No.
Is it going to be?
What?
Possibly.
We'd love it to be.
We'd love it to be. I'll leave that there. I would love to see it on console. I think it's one of those games.
It's on Apple TV as well.
There you go. Well, I don't understand what that really means.
Yes. I love my Apple TV. I wish there was more stuff on Apple TV. I feel like I'm one of the 10 users of Apple TV. It's very cool.
How have you both found those conversations in terms of taking your games onto these kind of big platforms? Like, I've been in Sony and talked to the indie guys there the little team there. And you know, they love it. They love meeting people. And they were really selling to me this fact of, like, you know, we're not hiding behind, you know, email signatures or anything. We're going out and meeting people. And I love that. I love the way that this is kind of like this, almost like tiny little, not tiny, like sort of a cottage industry side to massive console gaming.
Sure.
Is that in your experience?
Like, yeah, it varies from company to company, I think is the polite way of saying it. No, I think, yeah, there's the big companies have gotten very good at hiring the kinds of people who can talk to us. Mm. Who can talk to us when we show up in our t-shirts and jeans at these meetings.
They're not shocked.
It's always funny. Whenever I visit Sony, there's always like a group of like people in very nice suits. Mm. And then you always see like two people who are dressed like I tend to dress in the corner, and you're like, okay, there's I get who they are, I get who we are.
Yeah.
And Sony, I think, are very good at, yeah, they've got a team in place over there that's great, and I think everyone does at this point. So no, it's been really cool. It's also varying degrees of, you know, hands-on stuff. We're also on iOS and Android, and we've been selling Thomas Was Alone on Android for years, and I just met someone from Google for the first time a few weeks ago. Like, it's possible to with the mobile platforms, it's possible to release a game on there having never met anyone who actually works at the company.
That's very accessible. I think that
it is amazing, right? It's a very great, it's a big open door. Obviously, that brings with it its own complications, but that's very cool. Consoles, there is much more kind of organization involved in talking to these people, working with them. We have, like, literally my business partner, Alexander, that's a massive part of his job, is just dealing with platform owners. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a big job to do a console release still. But they're all working on fixing that and kind of speeding that process up. Mm.
Yeah, I think that in terms of actually getting on the platform, one thing that's changed a lot in the several years has been digital downloads becoming normal. Because, mm-hmm. Steam was probably one of the biggest online stores, obviously, for a long time on PC. But then when it was on Xbox Arcade, you could download indie, you know, or small production games on Xbox Arcade. But it was very much like, these are the normal games that come on discs. These are the weird games that come on arcade. Yeah. But now, I think even the fact that Sony and Microsoft Xbox have full games next to the same indie games that are also digital downloaded, it's become much more of a accepted way of doing it, and which gives the smaller games that aren't going to be on disc a lot more credibility, I guess.
And then there's this weird loop back now where we're doing disc releases, where indie's starting to do discs.
I saw Brothers on disc recently.
Yeah, we're doing volumes coming out on Vita first. We're using that as a test case, but we're releasing a physical Vita edition of volume and stuff like that. It's
you and no one else at the moment.
It's interesting though. There does seem to be an opportunity there.
Is it for the prestige of it actually being a product, or is it?
It actually genuinely makes business sense. Yeah, there's a market out there for these physical games now, because the physical release has become like a prestige thing in terms of the player, like in terms of gamers, like they want to collect. You know, there's lots of people who collect these games. Okay. It makes a lot of sense. But the and you also see the big companies we talked earlier about, like what have the big studios kind of taken from indie, and like you look at something like the Hitman release. That you can't buy that on. I don't think you can buy a box, can you?
Not yet. Not until early next year. Yeah.
So that's a game that's being released episodically. That's coming out. It's my game of the year so far. But I am a massive Hitman fan. And that's something that again gives credibility to this. We're seen as real games now. We're competing on a level playing field, which is great.
Yeah. And does that come with certain risks then? I mean, you mentioned about how comparatively easy it was to get a game on mobile on the Play Store or maybe on the App Store.
Mm.
But of course, the competition there is insane.
Ridiculous.
Versus the PlayStation Store, where you might be one of three or four games out that week.
That's shifting. That's definitely shifting. I mean, we were really lucky with volume that we didn't have much competition when we launched. But like, I think the following week, there was something like 15 games came out. Like, it's changing. And that's because the platforms are getting open. But that's honestly, I think that's healthy. I think that's good for us. It keeps us honest. You know, we have to make good games.
And
there's a lot of marketing involved in that, and a lot of luck as well. A lot of completely unimaginable kind of forces that you have to at a certain point just hope for the best. I think that's a sign of a vibrant kind of community of game devs.
Yeah, I mean, putting Lumino, for instance, on iOS. I mean, it already had a bit of. Hype's the wrong word, but
it already won a BAFTA before we put it on there as well.
So. But I mean, you're going on to, I mean, you know, having 15 games a week is all right, but like the App Store is what, like 450, 500 new apps a day or something. I mean, what does that do to your heads when you're going into that marketplace? Do you have to think like, well, there is luck, you know, but we have to really be on our game here, otherwise we're going to get lost in the flood.
Yeah. I guess like Mike said, it makes you more honest. It also kind of makes you more polished and make sure you really, really do a good job.
Make sure it's ready, yeah.
Yeah, make sure it's ready. Make sure, yeah, there's no hard edges, I guess. Mm. And I guess inevitably you'll be reviewed and inevitably someone will hopefully write something hopefully good. Yeah, from there, it's kind of about exposure.
There's also that survivor bias that, you know, the games, those of us who do manage to have success on these platforms, people tend to assume we're very clever and that we did it by making all the right choices. And in many cases, the people involved also think they're very clever and came up with the right choices. And often, you know, that's very hard to gauge where you necessarily got it so right, you know.
Yeah. And does that help as well, having that precedent? Like, whatever you guys do next, you know, oh yeah, State of Play, I know them, they made Lumino City, they won that BAFTA, that was amazing, I want to see what they do next, you know. For Volume, I guess, it's like, well, he made Thomas Lennon,
we get a lot of benefit from that. I definitely, in the PC and console space, I'd say on, I don't know how you feel about it, but I definitely say on mobile platforms, I don't think the audience is necessarily as aware of that history. Is that fair?
Yeah, potentially. I think a lot of people seem to find games on the App Store front page as opposed to reading the blogs, and there they're less likely to know or realize who made it.
Might check the reviews more. They're like, so in the mobile space, maybe user reviews is a
or featuring by platform holders. I mean it comes down to the getting as many eyeballs to see your game as possible ultimately, and having a, as you say, like a polished kind of, you know, making people want to purchase it. Goes back to like trying to make a nice box art, you know, making those kind of things. But yeah, no, I certainly it helped us with Volume a lot, you know, that launch. You know, we had a lot of people just ready to do reviews and the coverage went up straight away because there was a precedent. And, you know, fingers crossed that'll continue for a few more games. It certainly helps. But the key thing as a developer is to try and work out ways that, you know, you use that not just to sell your stuff, but also to help other people and to kind of pull as many people up the ladder as possible before the door slams shut.
You see, I like how you mentioned that helping other people there. I did wonder if, you know, when you put yourself, when you get into this position of recognition, if you get questions from other people, other people want to make games, like, you know, how do I do this? And secondly, if you can actually find the time to occasionally, like, not put an arm around someone and go, come with me, I'll show you the ropes, but, like, you know, give people a little leg up. Like you say, like, you know, if you find yourself in a position where you can talk about someone else's amazing game, you can do, right?
Mm. Well, we make the time because ultimately enough people have helped us on the way. So it's...
I think I'm pretty outstanding. I find it quite outstanding. The indie game community are so helpful to each other and so friendly. And if you're chatting to someone, there's no rivalry. It's literally like, I really like what you do. And that's genuine. It seems very natural at the moment. I think
we all understand that we're not... I mean, on some level, maybe we're competing with each other, but ultimately we're just trying to create the best things we can create. And there's no, you know, doing very well doing damage my business.
And we have no ulterior motive.
Why not help each other to make as good games as possible? And also there's a lot of, you know, it's always very exciting because I might say 99% of indie developers are also, you know, massive fans of video games. So it's always exciting to find, you know, new voices doing new interesting work and support them. And yeah, we've helped many projects in terms of literally in financial terms, but also kind of just giving advice and support and just trying to be a member of the community.
So if someone is listening here and they're like, I've got a great idea for an indie game, or just a video game, forget about taking indie out of the equation, I've got a great idea for a video game. What are their first steps for making a video game? Let's assume they have some rudimentary knowledge of programming and stuff.
Make a video game. That's the first and last
step. Just make it.
Yeah, people always I think people think that there's some magical or slow process involved, but ultimately, every engine at this point, there's a free version. Grab it. Grab an engine that you think, if you're making something that you think would work in 2D very well, get yourself Game Maker. If you think that it would work in 3D, make it in Unity. And if you think that Unity games are ugly, get Unreal. It's a really straightforward process. Find an engine, start playing. And I think the big thing that I always say to people is that idea that's in your head for a game, if that idea doesn't sound super simple to you, if your idea is GTA with dinosaurs, pause. Wait for that, because you're going to have the opportunity in maybe a decade to make that game. I always try and suggest to people, make something small, make Pong, but make it good.
What I think is important, like I said with Project with Inks, just we had an idea, we prototyped it as quickly as possibly mm-hmm. could, showed it to our friends in the pub, whatever, like just get people playing and talking about it. It doesn't need to look nice. It just needs to like literally function. And I think that's if you're coming from the idea of the actual gameplay procedure being interesting and different. I think that's key to a lot of things. A lot of other things like the aesthetic and the polish will come later. Just make sure you have something playable.
That key system, if you will, that kind of, what do you want to call it? Like that kind of reward loop yeah. or something. Is there like, I do something,
your core mechanic,
I get something back. Yeah, I do yeah. something, I get something back. Yeah,
yeah, but I just, and it's fine to make, it's fine not to make something innovative and cool straight away. Mm. It's fine to make Pong, or if you're feeling particularly clever, try and make Tetris. Tetris is actually really tricky to make, so go for that. But I always suggest to people just make something, because the process of making games, the process of finishing games, mm. putting a menu system on there, making it so you can save yeah. your game, all these kind of things.
That would take you half the time, and it's not the...
Yeah, and it's not the sexy bit. You know, it's not, you know, game jams are great and they're fun, but you kind of, the reason they're great and they're fun is because you kind of miss out all those boring steps mm. that you have to do. But just get making stuff, get playing, and accept that, you know, the first thing you make is going to be absolutely terrible, and the second thing you make is going to be pretty bad. But slowly, there's going to be something that you make maybe 5-6 games down the road that yeah. you're actually like ready to... say, no, this is a thing. This is cool.
Mm. What's fantastic nowadays is that you don't necessarily need a degree in computer science, because mm-hmm. you're not going to be making the whole thing from scratch. You can use other people's assets or engines. You can make something unique.
Within legal reasons, of course.
That's what I'm saying. These things are free and open yeah. now. So you could make something that's at the core unique, but just borrow other people's art mm-hmm. for a while from the asset store, for example, on Unity, or you know the whole yeah. of Unity engine. You don't need to.
Well, make it about rectangles.
Yeah,
rectangles. That was like, good look.
You just never finished, did you?
I never finished.
I've got GCSE
in maths. That's my formal education.
Clone of Thomas Wasline. I seem to remember.
There's been a few projects inspired by Thomas Wasline, I'd suspect.
Quote yeah. unquote. Yeah.
But no, it's. Yeah, I think you've really nailed it there. Is like, I think people assume that computer games yeah. are harder to make than they are anymore. You know, there's been a massive swell. And yeah, the game, you know, Volume, people, you know, have hopefully either played it or seen stuff of it. Volume is a complex stealth game which has a bunch of mechanics that I loved from stealth games when I was mm. a kid. And I made all of the gameplay in that game. I coded myself. You know, we had lots of other people come in to do UI and server and all the really tricky stuff, but the core gameplay stuff is all me, and I literally have a GCSE in maths. I have no formal kind of programming trait. Like, it's possible. An idiot like me can do it. So anyone listening who if you understand anything about computer code, you're already a better programmer than me. So if I can do it, you can do it.
Excellent. Well, just finally then, just what's coming next? Like, obviously Vita, Volume, and you've got your game. Just remind us before we sign off.
We're doing the VR version of Volume, which is called Volume Coder, which is a free expansion to the game on PlayStation 4, which will be coming out around the launch of PlayStation VR.
October-ish, right?
I couldn't possibly put a date officially yeah. on anything that's happening with regards to Sony's platform. Okay. So there's that, and then like I said, there's a thing we're working on that is kind of super secret, but that's a smaller thing. We're just kind of making a little thing because of an idea we had. And then we have a podcast called the Bithel Games Podcast, which is about the boring side of
game.
Have you listened to this? So we have a podcast that fixates on the dull bits of game development. It's kind of it's because all the other podcasts do about, you know, game design and art and code and all the stuff I love. Our one is a series of conversations. I'm being incredibly mean about my colleagues, but it's like, we had our lawyer on there, we've had HR people, we've had like people who do the kind of the stuff you don't often hear about in game dev, so that's something we do as well. I think that's enough plugs from me.
Dan, yeah. So you've got Inks, isn't it?
Yeah. So we are finishing up a iOS game and hopefully eventually Android mobile game. It is... Yeah, it's a beautiful pinball game. So it's designed to look like a piece of art. And mm-hmm. as you complete the level, you're actually splashing ink, which runs and drips and gets pushed around by the ball. So when you're finished, you have this amazing piece of modern art. And but it also gets more challenging. It tricks you. It teaches you. It gets more components come in and steps you through hundreds of, about 150 at launch puzzles, more to come. Yeah. And in the long term, we have some more secret projects. They're mostly secret because you don't know what they are yet. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to take all of the things that you're passionate about, Luminous City, the narrative, potentially the aesthetic, certainly the ways of working and the non-conventionalness, and rechannel all that into some amazing piece that we're trying to work on. Yeah, so we're just very slowly like seeing what happens with that.
Amazing. Well, thank you both for coming in, and thank you at home or wherever the hell you are for listening. This has been the Vice Going Podcast. Come back next time, won't you? I mean, we won't know for sure.
It's a bit needy, Mike.
But come
it's
on.
A bit needy.
Bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.